Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 1st of February 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted to say we'll be joined by live video Skype link by Alex Thompson of Eastern Approaches. Alex, of course, will be bringing us up to date with some of the more interesting movements in and around, what's it called, the European Union, I think.
Yes. Where did January go?
Where did January go? We don't know. Time is speeding up. This is the theory of the UK column. A lot of people are saying it. And interestingly, it's not people, just people of a certain age. It's also youngsters as well. So I think clear evidence, I'm sure the BBC would find clear fake evidence for the fact that time is speeding up.
So, Brian, we'll start off with Theresa May and Donald Trump. And the question that sprung to my mind from this image was, is this how she got pregnant?
She's not pregnant, as far as I know. That was just a rumour. They were only holding hands.
Right, okay.
So don't get too panicky, but she is in an illuminated red jacket, which I think is probably significant. And, of course, this was the first time that Jezebel had been able to lecture Mr. Trump, and it's been fascinating to watch this unfold. So we've got ignoring Donald Trump's travel ban could cost an entire generation of British Muslims. Apparently every Muslim in a particular generation in Britain was planning to travel to America.
Right.
Probably they were all going to go to Disneyland at the same time. So is that fake news? It's a very interesting headline. And then in the background, we've got Amber Rudd. She's looking a little bit tired, Mike. I have to say, I'm not sure whether this lady's up to the job. I wouldn't be surprised she steps down because obviously the strain is really beginning to tell. But remember, this is the same Amber Rudd that has not done anything to find those missing Syrian children in Britain. So she's speaking out, attacking Donald Trump. That nasty man has banned Muslims from US, in particular Syrians, and this is going to be a propaganda opportunity for ISIS. That's quite a headline as well from The Guardian. So she strengthened Britain's criticism of Donald Trump's travel ban, branding it potential propaganda opportunity for the Islamic State. But she's been criticised by MPs for taking several days to air her concerns. She says, I think the important thing is for the government to state that we disagree with the ban and we've said it's divisive. It's wrong. I'll continue to say that. But she doesn't say anything about those 324 missing Syrian children. And the other man who doesn't say anything about those missing children but is happy to try and criticise Donald Trump is our old friend leader of the Lib Dems, Tim Farron. He says Rudd was right to point out how divisive and counterproductive the travel ban was, but it should not have taken tens of thousands of people protesting in the streets to force the government to find its backbone. I took the opportunity to speak to Tim Farron's office this morning. I wanted to say, how did he reconcile an attack on Mr. Trump over his ban on, amongst others, Syrians, when Mr. Fallon appears to have done nothing to locate and protect the Syrian children in Britain? I was faced with his press officer, who simply gave me his opinion until we got to the point where I asked him whether he was actually an agent for Mr. Farron, and I could therefore take his response as being an actual response from Mr. Farron. He then seemed to get rather blustery and confused, but continued to give me his opinion. Well, the opinion of Mr. Farron's press officer is that Mr. Farron did stand up for the Syrian children, but unfortunately, there's no evidence to see what he has done to contact the police or the Home Secretary or the Prime Minister or any of the child protection charities to establish where over 300 Syrian children have gone, simply disappeared in Britain. Mm. And he said in an email, I think it was to you, Mike, that he was happy that quite a few of those children would have been trafficked, sexually abused.
Well, to be accurate, he didn't use the word happy, but nonetheless, what was clear was a fairly dismissive attitude of this.
So he wasn't happy, but he was dismissive.
Yes.
Okay, well, we're going to stay on his case. But the point we're really trying to make here is the hypocrisy of Theresa May and Amber Rudd here. They have had a child abuse whistleblower in solitary confinement for 10 months. That's torture under UN definition and also EU definition, I believe. But these same women are lecturing Donald Trump on who he can allow into the country. Alex, perhaps I could just say to you, I almost find it difficult sometimes to find adjectives to describe our politicians. Hypocrite is very polite. Should I be saying something else?
I think hypocrite is a fair enough word, Brian, for those who accept the premise of the need to act integrally and without hypocrisy. Now, that particularly includes the churchgoers and the self-described committed Christians in Parliament. Tim Farron is definitely one. He's the only party leader that would be in that bracket, although, of course, our Prime Minister is a vicar's daughter. I don't think she's much of a churchgoer at the moment, so she perhaps doesn't hear a need not to act hypocritically. But no, the attitude you have, Brian, is fair enough. These people have pledged to defend the weakest in society, and they're simply not doing it.
Thank you for that.
Okay, let's move on. RT, Western MSM, complicit in fueling artificially ignited Syrian war. That's according to Bolivian filmmaker to RT. So that's the headline. This is Carla Ortiz, the director of the Voice of Syria documentary, and RT reporting that she recently returned from Syria, where she visited regions which suffered the worst from the conflict. What was Carla Ortiz saying? She was speaking to RT Spanish. She was saying that only when I started to get into it, I realized that the reality which exists on the other side is completely different. It drastically contradicts what I supposedly knew about it, the war in Syria. She said that the conflict is portrayed by Western media as something natural and organic, but she left with the feeling that it's an artificially created campaign orchestrated from the outside. The war was deliberately and meticulously staged, she told RT. And she said, after having travelled three-fourths of the country, I realised that my dialogue with Syria's people always repeats itself, regardless of a place, social rank and even religion. I got the same answer everywhere. The war was created artificially. And one other thing that she said, which I just want to reiterate once again, because it's a point that Andrew Ashdown and also Vanessa Bailey have made many, many times. She said that I made a mistake once. I asked one man, are you a Muslim? And he told her, I'm a Syrian. We don't ask about religion in Syria. And that, you know, that just want to reinforce the attitude of people within Syria. Now, of course, Brian, this is your article on this exact subject. So whereas Carla Ortiz was being quite general in her comments about this and reporting what people on the ground are saying, we've been quite specific about this and who is responsible for starting this war. BBC Media Action is right front and centre.
Well, this is the key thing, and the article encouraged people to go and read it. I know that many people still haven't read it. Can I encourage you to do it? Because in the article, I'm using the evidence in documents that's come from BBC Media Action, so you can hear them say in their words how they got in to assist the anti-Assad members of the government and the establishment, how they helped them come forward to speak. So the BBC in there at the beginning. And then, of course, we can see EU policy being enacted out and British foreign and Commonwealth policy, which, of course, was regime change. And the UK government has been paying BBC Media Action to push this process forward. The EU has been funding them, the American State Department, the Norwegian government, I think, also, and Bill and Melinda Gates, who are well known for their humanitarian viewpoint. So have a look at that article. The evidence is clear. Since at least 2004, the BBC was working inside Syria to help forces hostile to President Assad.
Now, one thing we've said is that since the failure of the Syrian war from the Western elites, point of view at least, that the front was likely to, the attack was likely to move back to the Ukraine. And of course, BBC Media Action absolutely active within the Ukraine, not only training journalists but also running a youth drama program. We've discussed the reasons for that. Ukraine, of course, back in the news because indeed there's been fighting in eastern Ukraine in recent days. A significant increase of fighting in Donbass, particularly focused around the town of Avdiivka, and Ukraine has apparently declared a state of emergency there. There's Boris Johnson on screen at the moment. He had this to say: over the past few days, we've seen a high number of casualties, and the humanitarian situation has deteriorated drastically. Many civilians are without water, electricity, heating, while outside temperatures are as low as minus 20 degrees. The immediate priority must be security and a full sustained ceasefire in line with the provisions of the Minsk Agreement. I urge all parties to demonstrate restraint and help facilitate crucial repairs and restore vital utilities and assist the vulnerable. Sanctions against Russia cannot be lifted until the Minsk commitments are fulfilled. The UK continues to stand by Ukraine in full support of its sovereignty and territorial integrity. And I'm quite sure BBC Media Action would support those words absolutely, Brian.
Yeah. If I can just add to that, Mike, the article is BBC Media Action subversion from Broadcasting House Kazakhstan. If you read that article on the UK column website, you'll find towards the end there's a section about the BBC and Ukraine.
Alex, you've published an article on the Ukraine in the last couple of days. Why is Sir Gerald Harth in bed with Ukraine's Lady Godiva?
Yes, Mike, this charming lady in the picture is a lady I referred to in my appearance last week, Svetlana Zalishuk. And if you read my article, you will find at length how she is a change agent. She started off as a journalist and a manipulator of the news in Ukraine. She seemed to be quite proud of that record. She got herself a seat in parliament after the second Soros revolution within a decade in Ukraine. And she then came over at the head of a delegation to the British Ukrainian Society, to a meeting they had in Parliament, hosted by Sir Gerald Howarth, MP, who, for reasons unclear to me, is a fan of Ukraine and of its regime, and who co-hosted the meeting. And then, of course, we had the interruption, which we covered last time, from the independent journalist. It's rather timely that we should bring this up, because as well as mentioning the role of Guy Verhofstadt, more of him later in the news today, I think, the role of Guy Verhofstadt in pushing against the elected president of Ukraine and supporting the revolutionaries on the streets by saying that the EU was going to put sanctions against the government. We also have this factor of bombardment. You mentioned Avdiivka there. The very fact that Western outlets and foreign ministries are calling it Avdiivka in the Ukrainian language is very telling. There's no native Ukrainian speakers within 100 miles or more of that place in Donbass. They all speak Russian. The name of the place was always Avdiivka. It was given the Ukrainian variant Avdiivka, like all the places in eastern and southern Ukraine, when Ukraine became independent in 1991. And, outlets like BBC and the Foreign Office are pledged to use the Permanent Committee on Geographical Names Convention's names. So they're actually just, even with the very language they're using, they're showing that they have nobody on the ground and they have no sources reporting, because nobody uses the form Avdiivka out there. I see that the Daily Express is at it as well. So be very careful, and you can find out a lot from the form of names. That was just a little digression. Yes, you mentioned that there's the bombardment going on and how Graham Phillips, the independent journalist, asked Gerald Howarth and his Ukrainian sidekick about this. Well, here we have evidence of what this bombardment is doing. You've been hearing about how the bombardment has caused civilian casualties in freezing temperatures. Well, here's some of these civilian casualties. They're actually 207 miners who for some while were entombed underground because of the power cuts caused by the shelling.
Let me just show this, just a few seconds of this video, and then we can talk about it, Alex.
Сидели, ждали, пока дадут напряжение. Сообщили, что напряжения нет, все стволы обесточены.
Была обесточена шахта «Засядька» под землей, осталось 203 горняка, и 4 человека остались в клети, которая в это время поднималась. На данный момент работают там подразделения горноспасателей, происходит эвакуация людей. Она немножко осложняется тем, что есть замерзание клети, и она не поднимается с той скоростью, которая должна подниматься. То есть это медленнее происходит.
So,
So you see there that, you know, if you bombard a town or its power station, then not only are going to be people going to be left in the freezing cold, but miners, and that whole area is riddled with coal mines, are going to be stuck in their cages and stuck in their shafts. Thank God they all came up, but when they came up, there was no hot water to give them showers or hot drinks because there's no power.
So that's what Britain is supporting at the moment, then?
That's exactly what Sir Gerald Howarth is doing by embracing the Ukrainian regime so closely. I accept that this is, in the neutral sense, propaganda, what we showed, because it's from the Donetsk People's Republic. But then again, as I said, those are pictures on the ground and interviews with the emergency response teams who are men born in those towns. Whereas the stuff that the Express and the Foreign Office is putting out is from stringers in Kiev at the closest, and sometimes not even in Ukraine. A bit like the situation in Syria, where our MPs and journalists don't go to Syria and rely on, well, in one case, of course, a stream of information churned out of a bedsit in Coventry.
OK, brilliant. Thank you, Alex. Let's move on to domestic issues and police. And the Police and Crime Bill has received royal assent, so it is now the Policing and Crime Act. This is a key bill, according to the government, in the police reform agenda. And yesterday it got royal assent. The government marked this major milestone. And what did they say? Let's have a look and see what Amber Rudd had to say. She said that the Act is a major milestone in far-reaching police reforms over recent years. She said the measures in the Act give greater protections to the vulnerable, ensure the police have the necessary powers to keep our communities safe, and overhaul the police complaints and disciplinary systems to increase accountability and improve police integrity. So that all sounds very good. Our old friend Brandon Lewis, he had this to say. He said, police reform is working and crimes traditionally measured by the survey have fallen by a third since 2010 to a record low. He said, I'm delighted this act has now received royal assent, and in close cooperation with police and fire stakeholders, we will work hard to implement the Act's provisions to further improve the effectiveness and accountability of the emergency services. So what is in this, just as a reminder, because this is a spectacular change in the way that policing and other emergency services work. So aside from things like reforming pre-charge bail and so on, what they're talking about is to enabling chief officers to make the most efficient and effective use of their workforce by giving them the flexibility to confer a wider range of powers on police staff and volunteers, whilst for the first time specifying a core list of powers that may only be exercised by warranted police officers. Now, Alex, I'm going to go through a couple of these, but I want to just ask you about that one first, because from a constitutional point of view, there is no difference between the powers of the police and the powers of the individual, except that they clearly have some form of protection if they make a mistake, But what they're trying to do, it seems to me, is they're trying to put a statutory curtain around powers which otherwise and effectively limit those to people with a warrant card, which were in fact unlimited in the past.
That's exactly right, Mike. The French and others on the continent have the opposite system, of course. So if someone tries to bring injustice to book in France, the response will be, vous n'avez pas la loi, you don't have the law. But in the Commonwealth and in the common law jurisdictions, we are the law. It's a good 45 years ago now, my father tried to deal with a neighbour whose girl was misbehaving and the neighbour wouldn't take care of it. So he lifted this girl up and plonked her back in her side of the garden as gently as he could, and the policeman was called. And the policeman, who was one of the younger ones then, so he may have served another 30 years after that, came out with the standard line of, Mr. Thompson, we can't be taking the law into our own hands now, can we? And of course, my father, like not very many of us, knew the right response, which is, we've given you the law. If you fail to exercise it, we will take it back because it was ours to give. And you're quite right, Mike. In Victorian London, there was a case proving that we all had the same powers because a citizen's arrest, we shouldn't use that term because the police are citizens and civilians, but a citizen's arrest was made of a suspected pickpocket, and the chap was taken to court by the pickpocket, or the alleged one, because he hadn't any proof that he had stolen anything, and the chap did not have the protections of an officer. because a constable has a presumption when he gets to court that he was doing things decently and reasonably in the course of his duty, but the rest of us don't have that. Now, you're quite right. The idea is to get us used to the system where sworn officers can do everything and the rest of us can't do anything.
That's right. I'm sorry.
I can leave it till the end, Mike, but I just wanted to say what is horrific here is that Brandon Lewis is the policing minister, of course, who was informed of the police, the Met police, not doing their job over child abuse. He was told that senior Met officers were blocking officers trying to do their job to expose child abuse. He was told that he was given the evidence, which included UK Column's interview with the Met police officer blowing the whistle. And what came back from Brandon Lewis? Nothing. Total silence. He will not answer emails. And of course, he is now complicit in the cover-up of that child abuse in London. How can this man possibly then stand up and say that he's helping to improve policing by this bill?
Well, we'll be polite and call him a hypocrite. Right, here's the next one. I'm going to ask you for your thoughts on this, Brian. Place a new duty on police, fire and rescue and emergency ambulance services to collaborate where it's in the interests of their efficiency and effectiveness, and enable police and crime commissioners to take on responsibility for the governance of fire and rescue services where a local case is made. This is again the mushing together of different services into one Uber service.
Yes, and it's insidious and dangerous because, of course, it's all done on we've got to save money. We need different men and women with different specialist areas to be pushed together so that it can all work more efficiently. But actually what happens time and time again is you dilute the professional capability and you get the worst of all worlds in it. This has been seen time and time again in the military, where there's been an attempt to have people with three or four different specialist areas instead of one or two key ones.
Yeah.
And the other one I believe that's connected with this, Mike, is they want to draw these people together, police, fire service, first aiders. Then the training is going to start. And that training is going to be reframing. It's not necessarily going to be done by common purpose, but you are going to see more and more applied behavioural psychology, which will be layering over these individuals what they can do, and they're going to believe what they're told totally.
Yes. Okay, now, next week, I was speaking to Patrick Henningsen last night. Next week, we're going to declare Fake News Week, and we're going to really push, highlight what we see in the mainstream media, which is just utterly fake. But I'm going to preempt that by having a fake news story today, because this is the Daily Express, and this article is just disgraceful. Shock claim in capital letters: United States is plotting surprise nuclear attack on China and Russia. That is the headline. It says the United States could be the subheadline. Then already watering it down, the United States could be planning a surprise nuclear attack on China and Russia, a former U.S. Army major has warned. And you go down through it, and they're talking about a report which could be interpreted as a signal that the U.S. is preparing for a preemptive strike. So we're even watering down even further. And as we get down the report, they then eventually quote former CIA officer Paul Giraldi, who is saying that I think it's an outlined contingency plan, and I see no evidence that it's initiated personally by any of the identifiable hawks that they're talking about earlier on in the article. But it's contingency planning. It's the type of contingency planning that they've done regularly over many, many, many years. This headline is a disgrace. And who is the journalist who's pushed it through? It's this young lady, Katie Mansfield, straight out of nappies or something. I don't know, but she doesn't have a clue. But that article was the headline article on the Daily Express website yesterday evening. And Alex, again, hypocrisy is the word here, because for anybody, any mainstream journalist, to criticise any other news outlet or pseudo news outlet on the internet for pushing fake news when they're pushing this kind of dross, it's just... I can't even find the words for it, frankly.
We're struggling today, Mike, because it's so obvious.
Yeah. Alex.
No, just to agree again, Mike, because I think there's a sense of being rumbled. I'm not sure about Katie Mansfield there. I mean, you can fire arrows at me afterwards for chauvinism, but I don't think a woman in her 20s is fit to report on any military matter. But and that said, even if it had been a 50-year-old man reporting this story, you know, there would have been a sense of, you know, we can get away with it, we're the mainstream press. But I think among the editors, there is a sort of annoying realization dawning that we're, you know, eating their lunch, as it were, and jolly good that we are too, because what's being put out by mainstream media is not even fact-checked now. So there is a sense also that revenue is being eaten away, because, of course, people get fewer views, less advertising revenue, fewer subscriptions are coming in. And so there is this aggressive angle, as you pointed out that this week, both of you, Mike and Brian, that there is actually a perverse incentive now to produce fake news in the mainstream, because that's the only way, the shock and sensation value, that they can get the clicks and the views again.
And the irony is, of course, that actually in the long term, that turns more and more people off. And they end up actually in a downward spiral down the plug hole.
Yeah, the news is not where it was a year ago. The Daily Express of 2 or 3 years ago was the first newspaper to come out and say that we needed to leave the European Union. The Daily Telegraph of that era had blogs. The Express has gone by the board. The Daily Telegraph media has become a joke. It's slashed its staff. The head of digital was actually at a conference just a couple of months ago, as reported by Guido Fawkes on order.com, saying that, you know, here's a story about a royal baby, which is not newsworthy at all, but we put it up and it really increased our hits while it was on the front page. And of course, that video was reported by Guido Fawkes, who's got Fleet Street sources, has done the rounds of his own team, who groaned and have since started tweeting at him and saying, you know, you're useless. Why are you firing people? And you know, there's no confidence within the media establishment anymore. The current generation of journalists, I think, are either, you know, voting with their feet or just becoming demoralised.
So, Brian, then we need a reality check.
We do. Let's bring in the BBC, because remember that the BBC is now checking what is true. It's rooting out fake news across the internet. So I went to their Twitter page today. This was the first one. It says POTUS, so we're talking US, has capped the number of refugees to be admitted this year. I wondered what the fake news was here, but when you click on this, it takes you through to the website. And then there's a key question, because the website says, reality check website says, has the number of refugees in the US, and in particular those from Syria, risen in recent years? So what I couldn't find is where the report was that they were checking. Mm. And of course, it doesn't exist, because actually what the BBC is doing is simply just working through the material itself. This is propaganda, because you were led to believe they were checking something. But ultimately, I just took the bottom section of the article. This is really what they do. They say, well, the UN figures say that Turkey has taken 2.9 million Syrians. It says that the EU is reporting that the EU has taken 844,000, of which Germany has taken the lion's share. And then, I think this is it, Mike. We've got the implication here that those nasty Americans have only taken 1,682 Syrians in 2015 and 12,500 since 2016. But if you refer the whole article back to that question, where was the report that the BBC is reality checking? Well, it isn't. What they're doing is just spinning the public brain into this mush of statistics, which doesn't prove anything. In fact, you start asking, as I have, what the question is. Mm. So this is the BBC blatantly playing with people's minds. And of course, at the moment, I'm going to ask a question. We don't actually know what the Conservative government's behavioural insights team is doing, because it's a social enterprise company. Yeah. It's a social enterprise company now. It was civil service. Now it's a company. Is it working with the BBC to change the way we think and believe? I'm not suggesting that's true. I'm putting it forward as a possibility.
Yeah, but it would be subject to commercial contracts. Even though the BBC is subject to freedom of information, that would not be.
No. Well, you wouldn't want that. No. Tony Blair started it, of course, and he's very unhappy he did start Freedom of Information.
Yes. Well, another little news-related story here from Reuters that David Cameron tried to have Paul Dacre of the Daily Mail sacked. This is over their Daily Mail's coverage of the European Union referendum, apparently. Reuters saying Cameron, who led the campaign for Britain to stay in the EU, met the owner of the Daily Mail tabloid, the country's second biggest selling newspaper with the largest online audience, to urge him to either rein in or sack its editor, Paul Dacre. And so there you go. Lord Rothermere, who owns the Daily Mail, told them where to go, but then they wouldn't. He would not comment on this specific story to Reuters or and so on. But
and we should say here pretty forcefully that it took the courage of Paul Dacre to produce that 11-page exposure of Common Purpose a couple of years ago.
You're being very kind.
Well, I think credit where it's due, Mike. He pushed it out there.
Okay, whose work was it?
Well, it was UK column work, but. Yeah. I take your point.
Okay, Alex, France. François Fillon has been experiencing a little bit of spotlight recently.
He's there with his wife, Penelope Fillon, who is Welsh-born, and he has given her a sinecure, a job without work, it appears. Many tentacles to this, but to keep it short, he got a parliamentary assistant's role, or he nominated it for it, and it turned out she had no parliamentary assistant's badge and no email at Parliament, at the Assemblée Nationale. And then it was found out that he'd asked a mate to have Mrs. Fillon write a couple of fluff pieces for an article which Fillon's mate owned, and for that she was given another 100 grand. Then it turns out that his daughters have been given other sinecures, and we're up to just nudging under a million euros for this. Now, unlike Britain, France takes this seriously and says, well, they have a need to because they have so much of this fraud, and they say that it's not illegal for parliamentarians to employ wives and daughters, but they ought to show that they have actually done something, and if they haven't, it's embezzlement of public funds, which is a very serious offence that's prosecuted well in France. This is happening at the same time as the French-speaking half of Belgium, Wallonia, has had a similar scandal in the town of Liège with Publifin, where all the politicians in what's been called a mafioso arrangement have clubbed together behind the front of, you know, a green energy company that runs things for municipal councils and have creamed off a lot of money. It's endemic. But the problem is, of course, that Fillon was the best hope of the establishment to run as a centre-right candidate, an establishment right-winger, against Marine Le Pen, who's still in the lead in the polls at 27-28%. And because of this, he's losing support. He was only at 19 or 20% anyway, well behind the socialist candidates and also Emmanuel Macron, who's running as a kind of independent liberal with a new party. So the equivalent of the Tories are really taking a hammering in France, the Gaullists. And with Fillon gone, they've got no other candidates other than Alain Juppé, the disgraced former mayor of Bordeaux, to step into his place. And Juppé had to spend 10 years out of politics as well because of exactly the same problem of creating ghost jobs, which didn't exist, and defrauding the public. So we have a real problem here that the French establishment would dearly love to put someone up who is not Marine Le Pen. And they're having a difficult time persuading anyone to vote for anyone who's not Le Pen.
But Alex, I mean, this must be another fake story because I mean, we reported the other day that the Global Corruption Index showed that really in Europe we have nothing to worry about with regards to corruption.
Absolutely, we were light yellow, weren't we? And our neighbours, Ireland and France, they were the dirty orange, and we were up there with the Scandinavians, who of course have absolutely no corruption at all. We're the best in the world, supposedly.
Yes. Okay. Well. Sticking with EU issues, fantastic article in Sputnik here. EU army is a bigger threat to people in Europe and beyond. This is an interview that has been done with Robert Auld of the Bruges Group. And I do recommend people go and read this and also listen to the interview. It's great to see this subject breaking into the mainstream. You got any thoughts?
Well, I think this is the good work of David Ellis and Strategic Defence Initiatives. He pushed around that paper about the move towards the European military, including the Britain's nuclear deterrent, is being handed to the French as a precursor to full European control. This shows the lie of Brexit. And clearly that story has now created more than a few ripples on the pond. Well done to Robert Olds from Bruges Group for being brave enough to put it out there. Well, and Sputnik's followed up on it.
Yes. And here is Guy Verhofstadt, to apologise. Alex mentioned that we would be mentioning him in the programme. He is the chief Brexit negotiator from the European Union side. And he has been saying, he was speaking to LBC, that we need a defence union. What did he say? He said he was talking about the EU in general and its future structure. He said that European policies are not in place, taken for example borders and coast guard management, and he said politically and certainly also on defence, he thinks that the changes in the EU that are coming will be absolutely key. These particular areas will be absolutely key. And he also was speaking to Chatham House. That's right. He was speaking to Chatham House a couple of days ago. And he had this to say, that Brexit is a golden opportunity not only to discuss with British partners, but also to act together inside the EU. And I think he's giving the game away here, not only that EU Defence Union is a key negotiating point, but the fact that everybody concerned, both Britain and the EU, are taking advantage of Brexit to push this policy through, which otherwise might have been quite a bit more effort required to get
through. Brexit is the smokescreen, and behind that Brexit smokescreen, what are they doing? They are creating the EU military, and that EU military is to have a treasury, it is to have nuclear weapons, and those nuclear weapons are to include British nuclear weapons. So the lid is off this. We haven't seen any attacks from the press or even the BBC reality check challenging that David Ellis article about what was really happening in defence. Mm. Must be true then, because the BBC hasn't been able to prove it's wrong.
Alex, have you got a bit more background on this man?
Guy Verhofstadt, I absolutely have. You slightly were too charitable to him, Mike, in calling him the chief EU negotiator. He would like to be, but he is in fact the European Parliament's designated man. And the European Parliament is the poor relation in the trio or troika of power structures in the EU. So Verhofstadt is representing the members of the European Parliament in Brexit, but the power is held by Donald Tusk at the European Council, which represents the heads of government of EU member states, and most particularly by Michel Barnier, the French financier and former minister, who is leading the European Commission on Brexit. And he's keeping Verhofstadt out. Verhofstadt embodies the radical middle, this idea that if you can't get into power from a left or a right-wing perspective, you invent a centre party and call it Third Way or whatever. So he is chairman of the European Liberals bloc in European Parliament, and he has been accurately described as an EU nationalist. He comes from Belgium, which is a non-country, and he regards his nation, like a lot of intellectual Belgians, as being the European Union. So you can find all kinds of toothless rants from him in Parliament where he's talking about the awful Majesty's government, and if they want to save money, they can send more money to Brussels. This is the kind of man he is. In the Ukraine article I wrote, you will see a link to him doing a Hitler act in Kiev during the Soros revolution of 2 years ago, in which he says, "We will impose sanctions upon this nasty regime," in other words, the elected government of Ukraine. So he's a very nasty man and very anti-British. And you can see his game is exactly as he described. All his job titles are in my last article. While we're on him, here is a book I mentioned a while ago by Dirk-Jan Epping, who was high up in the European Commission more than a decade ago, The Life of a European Mandarin. And here I see a description of Verhofstadt's first unsuccessful attempt to become head of the European Commission. And it says here that he tried to butter everyone up. But he said Verhofstadt failed to take account of the fact that the appointment of a president is seldom put to a vote. In other words, he didn't achieve consensus between the French and the Germans. He says there is either consensus in favour of a candidate or not. This is 2004. In Verhofstadt's case, there was no such consensus. Yet even when this was clear to everyone else, Verhofstadt still refused to give up his ambitions. He held the leaders of Europe hostage until deep into the night, putting forward argument after argument in his own favour. It was only after the French president had personally explained to him that his cause was irretrievably lost that Verhofstadt finally agreed to throw in the towel. The other national leaders departed for home, but a disappointed Verhofstadt, and I think that's an undertranslation of a Dutch original word, it probably means crestfallen, Verhofstadt remained behind in the conference room for a further 30 minutes on his own. That's how much the man believed in his own destiny to lead the European Union. And he couldn't believe it that he'd not been elected or appointed European Commission President in 2004. And now he's trying again on behalf of the Liberals. So, you know, this is not a static situation. The rump EU, the 27 members, will not be the EU as it currently was, minus Britain. They will be a lot more openly federalist. I do see that defence union as a concept is spreading, and that John Redwood has written in his diary just today, I believe, that Donald Tusk's letter to the 27 remaining members of the European Union sets out, says Redwood, exactly what many of us expected to be the EU's next move, more progress towards a full political and defence union. Now, could it be that Mr. Redwood is mentioning this phrase because of David Ellis's articles and lobbying?
Well, in fact, Redwood's being somewhat disingenuous there, because Juncker, Jean-Claude Juncker, made it clear over a year ago when David, 18 months ago, when David Cameron was doing his grand tour of Europe in the run-up to the deal that he was presenting for the referendum, Juncker made it clear on several occasions that defence union would be a condition of the renegotiated relationship between Britain and the European Union. So therefore, if Redwood is saying at this point that it's becoming clear, he has known about this. He must have known about this for at least 2 years. Yeah?
Exactly right. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And Alex, let's look at this one then. This is from EU Observer. The headline is Secret EU Lawmaking Takes Over Brussels.
Here what we have is a description of the percentage of laws passed by the European Union's institutions which don't actually reach the public before they become law. The European Union is not only an international body, but we can never stress this often enough, it is also a supranational body, which makes it one of a kind. Countries can be member states of all kinds of international organisations, but their laws do not automatically become law in those member countries. The same is not true of the EU, because they have explicitly subordinated themselves to a government above, anterior and superior to their own government by treaty. And you can see how this process is done now in this article by Nikolai Nielsen in the EU Observer, which describes for the uninitiated about the trilogue procedure, where the Commission, the Council and the Parliament, those three again, never forget the EU consists of those three with the Commission in the lead. They get together. The Commission has the sole right of drafting a bill. The European Parliament does not write laws. No MEP can submit a bill. That's pretty unique in the world. I think perhaps North Korea and Cuba are the same. But all they can do is fiddle and moan about things that have come from the bureaucrats and the commissioners in the European Commission and from the heads of government of the member states. And here it's describing how the trend in recent years has been that up to 100% in some years of bills have not gone to a full second reading, because in the trilogue procedure, a select number of MEPs and a few chummy commissioners chairing the meeting and a few representatives of the member states of the EU at government level have got together and said, well, if we pull that section out, will it be acceptable to you? Yes, it's got traction now, has it? Okay, then through it goes. And all that happens then is that MEPs press a button from a sheet that they've been directed to, you know, hundreds at a time. Yes, no, yes, yes, no, down the list. And that's the extent of democracy in the EU.
Okay, thank you for that. Brian.
Well, let's bring this one up on screen. And I'm going to say thank you very much to the person who sent it through to me this morning, Lord Blencathra, to ask Her Majesty's Government, in the light of the release of Central Intelligence Agency documents concerning US proposals to offer grants to British citizens on the Falkland Islands to relocate to the UK, what discussions they plan to have with the government of the US concerning British sovereignty over the Falkland Islands. That's Hansard's source, 30th of January 2017. Now, I have not had time to get into this in any detail, so I'm giving this raw, but obviously the thing is real. Your famous lady, Baroness Ainley, responded, Mike, we have no doubt about the sovereignty over the Falkland Islands and surrounding maritime areas, nor about the principle and the right of the UK islanders to, Falkland Islanders to self-determination, as enshrined in the UN Charter in Article 1 of the two UN Covenants on Human Rights. It's up to the Falkland Islanders to decide their own future. We will continue to make that clear to the US. Well, I think this is a sidestepping of the question, because I think a huge number of questions need to be asked. And I'm just going to ask Alex for his very brief opinion on this. But a few days ago, we highlighted this. This was a memorandum where the director of Central Intelligence Agency and the director of the Foreign Broadcast Information Service were praising the BBC for their work, BBC monitoring, in helping the CIA. This was the, sorry for the overlay there, but this is the main a main piece here, is appreciation for the work of BBC monitoring. So we've got the BBC has been working hand in glove with the CIA for many years. And here we see the CIA, never mind trying to remove President Assad, here they are seemingly trying to undermine Britain's claim over the Falklands. This is dangerous stuff, Alex.
It certainly is, Brian. FIBIS, as we call it in for those in inside, as it were, is the American equivalent of BBC monitoring, and it puts its gist of news reports from other countries translated into a common pool or database together with BBC monitoring, so that a transatlantic shared database, exactly like GCHQ and NSA signals intelligence reports, except that with the news relationship, BBC monitoring is in the lead, and in fact the American equivalent, the FBIS, as it was, actually trails. It doesn't have as many good stories put out as BBC monitoring does. That was in the past. Both of them have changed now. In fact, that the FBIS has been called the Open Source Center for a long time. But you're quite right. It's an integral part of the CIA. So it didn't even have the same pretense that BBC monitoring always used to have, that it was at arm's length from the security services. It was the intelligence service. So FIBIS is, you know, pulling these reports out of other countries, particularly where there's an interest in forming a coup, for example, and sending them off to the US and UK jointly. They then go back into the pool of government policy making, put alongside intelligence reports and intelligence plans and strategies, and then the message is tweaked, you see, so that you've got a loop going on. So in the end, you have tweaked it to the extent where the target country, the victim country, is reporting the perceptions that you wish them to report before you take your action.
Right, Alex, this is really excellent material that's coming out today, and we can see response in the chat room. I'm afraid we're very short of time, so I'm going to say on that last topic alone, we'd like to cover that in more detail with you as a specialist area. But with an eye on the clock, I'm just going to end news today on this note. We are asked time and time again by people, what can we do? To which we say, do something, write an email, text, tweet, visit, shout, protest, organise, encourage, support, challenge, do something. And here's why you need to do that, because I can tell you today that as a result of your support and the public pressure, Melanie Shaw is now in remand accommodation. So she's been pulled out of solitary confinement. She has received at least one letter from Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary. She's now getting positive attention from the prison governor, Carl Davies. She's been able to sack her legal team and appoint a new team already known to her. She's been contacted by other prisoners who've suffered from child abuse and they want to talk to her. And she's got some real hope. This has only happened because of what you have done. Now, I'm going to be really ruthless here and say, if you're watching this report and you personally have not done anything to help Melanie Shaw, then, of course, you're not doing the right thing. The important thing is that if we're going to bring this very evil regime, which is installing itself, down, we need many people to act. And action conquers fear. We'll carry a more detailed report about Melanie tomorrow, but I just wanted to end on that very positive note. David, Alex, thank you very much for joining us. We'll end there. We will be back same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.